Penguin Random House Audio presents If Love Could Kill, The Myths and Truths of Women Who Commit Violence. This is the author, Anna Motz. Dedication. To three women who in different ways taught me much about the truth of maternal love. My friend and mentor, Estella Weldon. My daughter, Hannah, and my late mother, Lottie. Introduction. In more than 30 years of working with women who span the extremes of psychological disturbance, I've been confronted with descriptions of extraordinary violence and fantasies of worse. These stay with me, yet my most vivid memories are not of what patients have done or dreamed about, nor are they the moments of fear I have sometimes felt when sitting across a table from someone who has a violent history and may see me as their enemy. Instead, the episodes that most readily come to mind are quiet ones, in which little was said, but much was communicated about a woman's trauma and torment, the life experiences and psychological damage that led her to commit an otherwise inexplicable crime. I think, for example, of Miriam, who had lived for 15 years on the secure wing of a psychiatric hospital where I worked. She arrived at one session in an unusually frenzied state, so agitated that she was struggling to speak. Eventually, she was able to explain. Staff had searched and turned over her room after reports that she was keeping items not allowed on the ward, including razor blades, lighters, and medicine. Her carefully maintained set of possessions, including photographs, trinkets, and clothing, was in disarray, and so, as a result, was she. This might have seemed an overreaction, because having your room spun is a routine part of life in any form of incarceration. But for Miriam, I knew this was a particular torment. She had come to England as a refugee from Ethiopia, an unaccompanied child who had already known painful exploitation and neglect in her life. Having left her family and the horrors she had witnessed behind her, she encountered yet more difficulties as she grew up, living in hostels, in shelters, and on the streets. In a life that had known only instability, she hoarded and lovingly maintained her possessions in her room on the ward to create the closest thing to a stable home she had ever known. For her, having this room invaded and its contents plundered felt not far from the collapse of her entire world. Though the hospital staff were aware of the effect of disruption on a sensitive and traumatized person, the perceived threat to security trumped any such concerns. After the session, I accompanied her back to her room and watched as she scrabbled on hands and knees, searching through the items that were strewn all over the floor. She seemed almost in physical pain as she surveyed and tried to repair the damage, facing the reawakening of a lifetime of trauma. She looked at me and asked if now I understood. I could only nod in silence. Witnessing Miriam's torment and that of so many women I have worked with in prisons, psychiatric hospitals, and specialist clinics was a reminder of the human truths that accompany every criminal story. The women I work with may be convicted killers, sexual abusers, arsonists, stalkers, or child abusers, and are largely considered only in that light. Yet the perpetrators of crimes that shock and appall us have also, almost always, experienced an extreme form of abuse or trauma in their own lives. They are victims as well as perpetrators. As a forensic psychotherapist, I try to understand the connection between the two aspects of their existence and to help my patients do the same. My job is to probe the roots and psychological geography of the crime, deriving insight that may then be used as evidence during a trial, as the basis for risk assessments concerning child custody, or as the starting point for a course of treatment. The principle of forensic psychotherapy is that we look at the whole person, the factors that shaped them, and how experiences in one part of life ultimately prompted their development and actions in another. These links are not necessarily obvious or conscious and often only emerge after many hours of careful therapeutic work. That work must embrace complexity and contradiction, seeking to draw common threads out of chaotic lives, explanations that can offer a lifeline for people who might always have struggled to understand why they think or behave in a certain way. Together, we uncover and reconstruct the meaning of their offenses. Leading this process requires acceptance and equanimity, putting aside personal feelings about what a person might have done in order to help us both understand why. For more than 3 decades, I have worked in prisons, in secure units and hospitals, and in the community, acting in both assessment and treatment roles and working with female and male patients. I initially trained in clinical psychology using treatment models including cognitive behavioral therapy, a talking therapy that focuses on identifying and altering harmful patterns of behavior and thinking patterns, and the psychodynamic approach, which seeks to help an individual access and then understand their unconscious thoughts and feelings. But the vast majority of my work has been in the field of forensic psychotherapy, which brings the psychoanalytic approach into the field of criminality, using psychodynamic techniques to probe the motivations and meaning of a person's criminal actions. Many years of this work has shown me that this can genuinely help people to recognize unconscious influences in their lives that explain their actions. Moreover, this understanding can provide a solid foundation from which to treat and to some degree resolve these issues. In the best case, this can allow people who have been suffering intolerable and overwhelming emotions to control previously untamed impulses and regain some stability in their lives. In this forensic work, I've been most occupied by the crimes and violence of women. Female violence is a subject whose nature is frequently misunderstood and whose importance is too often disregarded. For many in society, from the media to some areas of the medical and legal professions, the reality of women's violence is a truth too uncomfortable to take seriously. A taboo that offends the idealized notion of women as sources of love, nurture, and care. That mothers sometimes harm or even kill their children is simply too shocking for many to engage with, as is the idea that women in caring roles could sexually assault or otherwise mistreat minors. Even to consider these things implicitly threatens our social fabric, bringing the shock of maternal abuse and female cruelty into comfortable lives in which the idea of the loving, caring family is so central. Our preconceptions about female violence are deeply embedded in history and culture. Stereotypes of vengeful women fill the pages of our oldest literature. The dangerous seductress, exemplified by the biblical tale of Judith beheading the Assyrian general Holofernes while he sleeps in his tent. The spurned wife driven to murderous rage in Greek tragedy, from Clytemnestra stabbing a helpless Agamemnon in the bath to Medea, so blinded by anger at Jason's betrayal that she kills not only his new wife, but her own children. Our depictions of violent women in the modern world are no less extreme. Women such as Dee Dee Blanchard, Lisa Montgomery, Eileen Wuornos, Myra Hindley, and Andrea Yates all became figures of tabloid revulsion, treated as outcasts not just from society but from womanhood itself. They were monsters, angels of death, manifestations of pure evil, made into demons who could be kept at a safe distance from the ideals they threatened. The indelible images of these women in the public mind, staring grimly from newspaper front pages, show that society has no villain like a woman who kills. Women involved with sexual offenders like Ghislaine Maxwell are also hate figures. They show how the idealization of womanhood in general, and motherhood in particular, can quickly turn to denigration and disgust against those.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?